the Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Now we're going to turn to GAA. I'm sure you've seen over the last week or so that the Armagh County Board have put forward Jarlath Burns as a candidate for the GAA presidency. A new president is going to be elected at Congress 2020 to replace John Horan and will serve a three-year term from 2021 to 2024. Delighted to say Jarlath is on the line with us now. You're there?
I am, Joe, yes.
Thanks for joining us. So when did you decide this was something you would like to do for real?
Well, I suppose it's something that a lot of people have been speaking to me about over the last 15, 20 years. I was thrust into the spotlight of the GAA administration straight after I finished my county career in 1989 when Sean McCaig made me the first Players Committee chairman, which was a committee he set up really as a file to the GPA at the time. And right away I was into Central Council, into the functions of governance of the GAA. I suppose I've just stayed at that ever since, as well as working with my own club. But over the last maybe two or three years, more and more people have said to me, maybe next time is the time that you should go make a bid for it. And I decided that, okay, went to the county, they were very keen for me to do it as well, and I decided to put my name forward this time.
Really, the majority of us would see the Director General as the person running the GAA. What is a president's role in your eyes? It seems like more of a ceremonial role than anything.
Well, the Director General does have a very important function in the day-to-day running of the association, and I suppose it's the volunteer's job to create strategy for the GAA and to create policy, and it's the job of the Director General to carry out the function of that strategy in the day-to-day run of the association. The president has a very important role as chair of the GAA management committee and obviously Central Council, and they meet the management committee meets every month, Central Council meets every 2 months, and then of course Congress, he or she chairs Congress as well. But it is a very important ceremonial role, and essentially it's to give leadership, it's to be the voice of the association. It's maybe if the association is under attack, to justify decisions that are made and just to defend the association's interests whenever required.
Yeah. And what about changing the association? You can't defend every policy, I'm sure.
No, and there are some policies maybe that various people might want changed in the association, and that always goes through a process, and I think the process that the GAA has had for this last number of years is instead of the president sweeping in with a whole lot of ideas which may not chime with others, or if somebody comes to Congress with a particular idea and just presenting a motion, we have to understand that an awful lot of changes affect other areas of the association. And what the GAA now does, and sometimes we get criticised for it, but it seems to be a good model, and it's used in business as well. We usually form work groups or task forces. They meet for a number of weeks. They look at all the options, and then they issue a report. And it is really the report that then ends up as a motion to Congress. Yeah. And you've seen, for example, with the new rules that's the way it was done, and with a whole lot of other changes the GAA has brought in successfully. You look at how each of these changes could impact on other areas of the association before you make a difference.
I guess a good example being the Standing Committee on Playing Rules. You were involved with that. That's one of the reasons we have the mark at the moment. That's the model that you like, that you're advocating.
That's correct, yes. Instead of a county just bringing a rule change to a Congress, that you actually have a committee that looks at it and is able to do research and have an evidence-based focus for change rather than just making change on the hoof at each Congress. That's crisis management. That's not strategic management.
I saw you did an interview with Declan Bogue in the Irish Examiner, and you made the observation, which a lot of people have made really, that I think we're at a crossroads with the GAA. I think we need to go down the road again of asking all the difficult questions of ourselves. What are we? Who are we? Why do we exist? And how do we see ourselves going in the next 20 years? So they are big questions. If we jump off, because there's a million different strands to that, if we pick off certain areas, so maybe we two broad areas, firstly, the ultra-competitive county scene, and then the GAA's place in the community and the club player. If we jump off with the county scene for a second, you've obviously played and you have a son now playing. Where are we in that regard? Where is the county game? Where do we want it to go over the next 20 years, to use your period of time that you're thinking of in terms of?
Well, we have five children to play. Every one of them play at different levels.
Yeah.
I have a son in a county minor final on Sunday, and I have a daughter in a county final on Saturday. I think that if you look at the GAA at the moment where it is, I actually think we're getting closer and closer to where we should be with regard to fixtures, particularly my own county, and in an awful lot of counties what they have done is they have looked at the Masters fixtures plan and have said, okay, that's the way that is. How are we now going to make our fixtures fit in around that? And what you have to remember is that, for example, if we look at fixtures, and that's constantly something that people criticise in the GAA, in a situation where you have provincial councils making fixtures, where you have central council making fixtures, and you have county board making fixtures, you have three sets of fixture making rules, and then you also have the universities making fixtures as well. It can create a situation where everything comes on top of each other. But I think what we need to do is where the GAA creates a master's fixtures plan and say, this is the fixtures plan that we have. This is based on a particular model of club fixtures. And if each county adheres to that, well, then everything would be okay. And the way Armagh does it, and a lot of counties are doing it now, you play their entire league and then it stops at the second week of August. You have a 2-week break and then you play the championship. And in Armagh, we play three matches. And it goes into a quarterfinal, semi-final. And that just works perfectly for us. And I think that a lot of counties maybe are very set in their ways as to how their championship is. And I know it works for them. And there's hardly five counties that have exactly the same type of championship. Nearly every county has a different type of championship. That makes it very, very difficult at a national level to create consistency for fixtures and give a meaningful fixture programme for everybody who wants to play the game.
And how close are we to doing that? Because it's always struck me as well as crazy that we've 32 different fiefdoms ruling themselves. And crucially, in a lot of cases, you have county managers with different personalities, some of them very forceful and very demanding in terms of the time they want with their players. And again, you just feel like this thing needs to be done centrally.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who would agree with that, that it should be done centrally. I definitely think that there should be somebody in each province with an overview of everything that's happening in the province, particularly with regard to some of the more gifted players. And, you know, if somebody, for example, if you look at in February, a player could be playing for the university, could be playing at the later stages of the club championship for their club, and could also be playing National League for their county. I mean, that's an intolerable situation. And the problem with that is, Joe, that every time you try and make a change for the good for the club, very often it can impact negatively in other areas. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. 2 years ago, there was a decision made to pull the All-Ireland right back to the last week in August and the second week in September. That has not been a popular move. That was a move that was made to try and give more time for club activity in the late August and September. And while it has achieved that, it has meant that we have completely ceded the whole month of September, which used to be the most important month for us in terms of publicity, to rival sports, to the beginning of the Premiership and to rugby. And that's something that we have to look at. And one decision made for very good reasons can impact very profoundly elsewhere in the association. And that has been an unpopular decision. And I actually don't think that that decision, next year it comes up for review, I don't think that All-Ireland will maintain at the last week in August and the second week in September. That's an example of something that's made in very good faith for a good reason, but has so many other negatives attending to it that you just say, no, the All-Ireland finals are sacred in the first and third weeks in September.
And where are we in terms of just ripping the whole thing up and starting from scratch? Because there is a frustration where on an annual basis we have discussions and things are done in piecemeal form, a change here, a change there. Like, for instance, that decision you've just mentioned, the moving of the All-Ireland final dates. And it just seems like we're going to be on this road for another 20 years. You know, can we rip things up? Can we start from scratch? Can we do something a bit revolutionary? Or is it going to have to be step by step and mistake here and two steps forward, one step back? Because it feels like we're on that road.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've talked about, and if you look at that interview today, you'll see me talking quite a bit about it. In 2000, going back to Sean McCaig's presidency, which I was very close to, he ordered a strategic review into the entire association and to really rip it up again, to put it all back together again, see what was working, see what wasn't working, but really look very much into our soul and the proposed change. It was very, very radical at the time, and it actually did an awful lot of good. And possibly the biggest change that came out of that was the Dublin situation, which was very, very dormant and was a real challenge for the association back then. And there was a strategic plan put in place as a result of that. But I think that with regard to the GAA, if you look at the fixtures, there is constantly going to be a situation of tension where you have all of these expectations and various people having expectations in the association. For example, if you look at Armagh, if Armagh had got into the Super 8s this year, they're definitely, that would have come straight into the middle of our championship. And I know that there would have been a clamour in Armagh to say, look, let's postpone our championship and let's give the players the best chance they possibly can to get into an All-Ireland semi-final. And, you know, Kieran McGeaney is our manager and he's works very, very well with the clubs, the same as a lot of managers do. But county clubs have a high expectation of him to deliver and to deliver success. And if we had been beaten by Down in the first round of the championship, he might have been in a difficult position. So it's trying to marry each of those things up, to marry what the priorities around the club are, to get meaningful games for players, and then to try and keep the county set up as competitive and as entertaining as possible. Nobody has yet been able to get the perfect situation for that, and it's going to be very, very difficult when you have so many competing interests.
Well, they're not compatible. I mean, the modern game, it's not compatible, county football and county hurling, with the club game, and you can dice it any way you want, but that is the bare problem laid out. You know, I would have played growing up GAA with the club and soccer as well, I suppose. When I got to 18, it was no decision to drop GAA and run a million miles away from the life of a club player. Like, and if we're going to get serious about it, like, do we envisage a point where the county player just doesn't play club football?
No, because I think that the county player does want to play club football.
Sure.
Want to play with their club. But I suppose, with regard to the league, and again, it comes back to the fact that we have all of these people making fixtures. I know I go back to my own county, and if you look into an awful lot of counties at the moment, they seem to have actually managed to get it right, because the complaints coming back from counties are getting fewer and fewer with regard to how it impact the county game is impacting on them. The recent changes with regard to the Super 8 made sure that by the, I think it was the last week in May, there was only 8 or 12 teams left in the championship altogether. And that has meant then that it left the whole of July and August for the rest of those counties to have their club leagues finished up and their club championships started. And now we're into September, and clubs are playing away in their championships, and there's some fantastic matches being played. So we're actually a lot closer to be now than what we used to be. Like, I know when I played county football for Armagh, I saw me on many an occasion playing a match for my club, getting into a car and driving to somewhere like Wexford or Wicklow to open a pitch for maybe 7 or 8 o'clock that night, playing 2 games and then training the following day. Having a son playing there, you see there's an awful lot more emphasis on player welfare. If they arrive at training, the first thing that's done is they're given an assessment to see from 1 to 10 whether they are fatigued, and if they're maybe an 8 or 9, they don't train. And I think all of those things are very welcome. But I suppose it's just the time that's involved in being a county player. But the vast majority of our county players really enjoy it. They really love playing for the county. They love the training. There's a culture among young people now of going to the gym, whether they can play or not. That's part of the culture of young people. So I don't think we should look at the whole... We should be more joyful about the county game and about how it impacts so positively on so many players and how much they enjoy it.
What about talk of professionalism? Is that something that should be resisted, whatever cost?
Absolutely. There is never a situation in the GAA where you could ever in any way entertain any talk of pay for play. And in fact, I would try and come at that from a different perspective, because for too much we talk about our amateur status and we cherish it and we say, well, there's no pay for play, therefore, you know, everything is great. But there is another massive element to the amateur status. You have to ask yourselves, why does the amateur status exist? And if you go back historically into the amateur status, why the GAA had it, it was so as it could be, the games could be available to everybody who wanted to play them. Now, if you look at county football and hurling at the moment, I would question that, because if you're living where I live and you work in Dublin, or if you're a plasterer or a joiner or whatever, the county game is really out of your reach, because you just don't have the energy and you cannot give the commitment that's required to county football and hurling. And I think that is something that worries me. And it worries me because in many respects we are helpless about it, because if you look at the All-Ireland final of this year and the incredible skills that were on show, the scoring, the passing, the handling, the going round players, the speed of Jack McCaffrey is incredible. All of that comes because those players have time and take time and take science to make sure they're the best that they can be.
Sure.
So if we want to continue the game at that level, and it would be wrong for us not to, that does come at a price. And I suppose you have to start asking ourselves, how much of this price are we willing to pay? Because I did use the word juggernaut. I think that if you compare, for example, Mick O'Dwyer, who never had one person in his backroom team, he just did it all himself, to the cottage industry that there is of backroom teams now at the moment, that is something that when you talk to county chairs, that they are very, very worried about the amount of payments. And a lot of managers are still not being paid, but an awful lot of their backroom team are taking up an awful lot of money. And I'm not saying that they're not doing a good job and a worthwhile job and an important job, and they wouldn't be there if the manager didn't feel that they could give that added little wee bit. But the ambitions of county teams at the moment are so great that they are really causing great pain for their county. I'm the Armagh executive. I'm leaving here now to go to an Armagh executive meeting. We'll probably hear how much the year has cost us. But, you know, that's part of what we're about, and we pay that very willingly. But it's a constant drive for getting sponsors, getting funding, getting finance. We ran a race day this year. And you just wonder at times, how much longer can this go on before maybe we have to step in and try and stop it?
Well, how would you step in and stop it? Say it gets to a point where literally you have to be a student or a teacher to play county football or something in that vicinity. And we're probably not far off it now in some respects. And there is the beginnings of a trend of players not working, putting their county football or county hurling first. So you say we might have to step in and stop it. I don't really see how you do.
Yeah, well, if you look at some context to that and look at it from a perspective of the GAA, you know, the prizes for winning the All-Ireland football and hurling have remained the same for 100 years, a cup for each. So that's not being driven at any level.
Yeah.
You know, the GAA's ethos of coaching at that level is to play and stay with the GAA. As I say, it's all about fun, the fundamentals. The GAA are not really interested in you know, certainly at schools level, developing elitism. Like John Horan has gone on the record for saying that he is against development squads because it breeds elitism. All of this is coming from within counties. And when any time that the GAA has tried to move in and to stem it by introducing a closed season, it was routinely broken. Now, I remember seeing the Paul McGrane a couple of years ago. He's a good friend of mine, played for Armagh along with me in 2002, and he's a great thinker of the game, and I would respect his opinion that unless there's a complete buy-in to a new scenario where up until the first round of the championship or really the end of the league, that every single team is only allowed to train on a Tuesday and Thursday, that's it, no other night. I mean, Paul laughed at me when I said that. He said, no, teams just laughed at that. They wouldn't do that at all, ever. So it is one thing coming up with a grandiose plan and a wonderful vision, but when you have if you take a manager and a team and give them a set of balls and a mission, they will go through anything and they will do anything to try and achieve victory and to try and win. And it's very difficult being an administrator in the middle of all of that ambition.
Yeah, I accept that. That's a fair point. So away from the county game then and the role of the GAA in the community, and that's it's a wonderful aspect of the GAA. The foothold it has in every community almost around the country is a fantastic thing. And we're seeing a sense of diversity about the association. We're seeing, you know, demonstrations of social inclusion. We saw Gay Pride just a couple of weeks ago. I know you marched as principal with your school in a Gay Pride march as well. So these are wonderful things. A common complaint we would get here is a sense that, in some respects, the volunteerism and the importance of community is forgotten in some respects. Like things which really bug people. And in some respects, they're probably small things, because I'm sure the Sky Sports money has not revolutionised the GAA. But things like the Sky Sports money, that bugs people. It bugs people that they coached players as youngsters, they gave up their time, they volunteered, and then when they're playing in a big county match some 15, 20 years later, they can't watch it on free-to-air TV. And people wonder, well, why is that? We're not paying the players. The revenue is over 60 million. Sure, you wangle a few extra quid out of RTE, but I mean, nothing seismic. People talk about the price of tickets. You're paying 50 quid for an All-Ireland semi-final ticket. You're paying through the nose for food and drink at Croke Park. You're paying €90 for an All-Ireland final ticket. You're paying €7 for a programme. They've upped the price of the programme 2 measly euro because they could. And you don't even get the team in the programme. You don't even get the team in the programme. They've upped it to €7. And you know, it looks, stuff like that doesn't sit well with people. It's a sign of the association losing its way, because I look at German Bundesliga clubs and they say things like, we will keep ticket prices down because we care about the fans. And I look at the GAA in some respects, Sky Sports deal, ticket prices, and I think it's okay. Like it's okay. It's not a rip-off. And you could say, well, look, we should pay down the Aviva. But frankly, the Aviva funds its entire wage bill, 86% of it, with revenue on match day for internationals. So it's not a good comparison. I look at it and I think it's okay, but they're squeezing pretty close to every last penny they can get away with without causing a major fuss. And I think in that broad area, we can talk about, you know, brilliant in the community, and it's a great thing. But I know you're involved, so I know you're on in the grassroots involved. I'm sure you've talked to grassroots members. Mm-hmm. A lot of them look at it and they think, like, really, something about this just doesn't feel so good anymore. And I think it's a very valid complaint. And I think that feeling is absolutely out there. and the GAA, you know, ignore it at their peril?
Well, that's a very long question. So you'll forgive me if I give you a very long answer. I'm going to try and break it down.
Sure.
Try and break it down here, right down to the first thing I'm going to do here is the Sky deal. The more I talk to people, the more I feel that this seems to be almost a tipping point for a lot of people, that why should GAA people have to pay for, you know, for viewing the GAA, which they love and which they give so much to. Now, there are two parts to this, and the first part is that every year the GAA shows about 150 games live. So, I mean, there was four games live last week. One of them was the county final in Fermanagh, for example, which I'm sure the crowd of it was greatly affected by it. There was one weekend where I think TG Carter showed something like 16 games live between streaming and online and everywhere else. 16 games, that was over the entire weekend. 14 games are given to Sky. 14 out of about 150 is about 10%. I don't think there's any organisation that gives as much free-to-air as the GAA. However, let's look at the narrative behind this. And the narrative, I think, that the GAA at a particular level has been reluctant to reveal, because you have to have a very strong relationship with your broadcast partners. Unfortunately, one of our broadcast partners allowed a lot of its pundits to come out with a very one-sided narrative about this. Particularly, I think it was one of the games, might have been Dublin Donegal or some game like that, that was only on Sky. Whenever the GAA did the broadcasting deal the last time, and they had it all more or less wrapped up, they went to RTE and they said, look, we would prefer if all our games were free-to-air. See this package here, 14 games. Why don't you buy it at this price? I mean, I'm not going to make any apologies for the GAA trying to get the best price that we can. RTE said, and it was a very cordial conversation, I'm very sorry, but we just don't have the funds to buy that package. So it was either that Sky take it or nobody take it. And that, I mean, some of those bigger games might have been shown if RTE had them, of course. But there is a very simple narrative here that if you look at whenever RTE had sole rights to the GAA, go right back to the 70s and 80s, whenever they used to show the two finals, the semi-finals and the final, six games live, that's all we ever got. And the GAA paid for that. So I'm not going to take any lectures from anybody in RTE about the GAA and how we have sold our souls.
But sorry, look, sorry to interrupt, and I hate to interrupt. I'm not an RTE pundit. Yeah. I'm not an RTE pundit.
I know you're not.
Yeah. So I think it's nonsense as well. And actually, when it was first sold in here, it was talked about as well that, you know, the immigrants over in the UK will get a better deal because they have these games on Sky now. And actually, it's cost them far more money. They had a much better deal before the Sky thing happened, where they had their Premier Sports or whatever the name of that channel subscription. We've done pieces on it in the past. Mm-hmm. They did a far better deal. They paid a certain amount, not much, and they got all the games. And now they have to pay for the GAA Go, and then they have to pay for Sky as well. So they're paying more, and that was one of the big selling points when it first started. So, and like you're saying,
You don't have to pay for GAA Go and Sky. You can pay a subscription to GAA Go, and you can see every game you want without having to go anywhere near Sky, because the GAA Go will show whatever game is on Sky or
okay,
RTE.
But cheaper before the Sky deal.
Yeah, but ideally, of course, it would be better if all our games were free-to-air. That is why the GAA offered the entire package to RTE, and RTE weren't able to take it. Now, I would love to think that there would be more free-to-air stations, you know, in the bidding room the next time, maybe, than there was the last time. Mm. But the GAA doesn't have the international bidding auction that happens with the FAI and with the IRFU. And what I absolutely take on board what you say, and I think that part of the strategic review would have to look at the entirety of broadcast rights and where we are going in the next round, because online, I mean, Netflix have now got involved in some countries, where we are going with that in the long term. But always remember, the GAA has a responsibility to our members, and because 87% of everything that we earn goes back to our members. We don't have shareholders.
Sure.
We have stakeholders, and our stakeholders are our members. And last year, there was 2.5 million invested in 424 club redevelopment projects. And for example, alone, 9 million euro it takes for the GAA to prop up the player injury scheme. 9 million euro was one All-Ireland. We only have two. That's one All-Ireland. So if we don't develop a relationship with Corporate Ireland, and if we don't try and get the best broadcasting deal we possibly can, the figures that we see going back into the association are just going to get smaller. Now, that might very well be a price our members are willing to pay to be able to watch those 14 games somewhere else. And if they are, well and good.
But the question will be then, you know, how many coaches are we going to make redundant as a result of that? You know, the GAA has hundreds of coaches, you know, and as if we have less money coming in, we would, you know, there'd be less money going out then. And it's just, it's this constant balancing act between our values and between what's important to us and our desire to try and get the best deal we possibly can for our members, because we're not a profit-making organisation. Mm.
And I presume, and with the clocks coming against us, that extends to ticket pricing, you're saying, as well?
Yeah, well, if you address the ticket pricing, I personally think that ticket prices are too expensive. I mean, I've said that before. I think the GAA charge very often too much. Now, the GAA, the All-Ireland is the GAA's big payday. I think it's 60% of all games that the GAA organise at national level are done at a cost, at a loss.
Yeah.
If you look at, I think it's something like 90% of any GAA games that you go to from underage are free. You know, so you can look at this from a whole variety of ways. Mm. Even if you look at the semi-final of the All-Ireland, you could take, I think it was the Tyrone match, you could take a whole crowd of young people from your club and they all get in for €5. There are various ways of looking. I think one of the best innovations the GAA has ever brought in regard to tickets has been the season ticket. Mm. Because gone are the days now where you hear of the fella who went to all of the National League matches and he doesn't get a ticket for the All-Ireland final. The season ticket is really, really good value. I think an Ulster council reduced the ticket prices and brought in various packages, and I think that worked very well. As a result of that, attendances were up, everything was up, and I think maybe, yeah, we that's definitely something we could look at. But we need to consult our members and we need to ask ourselves. Fewer, you know, 345 coaches working with clubs and schools throughout the country, that might go down to maybe 250 if we're going to reduce these ticket prices. But it's probably the same counties every year that have been hit with those ticket prices. I always feel for the likes of Kilkenny and Dublin and Tipperary, but, you know, they're walking off at All-Irelands. We only have one. I think that would be a price Armagh would be prepared to pay if we could get to an All-Ireland every 2 or 3 years.
The clock is coming against us, so shout when you need to run and we'll race through stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah, okay,
something I suspect which has come up are the comments you made a couple of years ago on the flag and the anthem in 2015. So, like, Brexit is kind of looming, and you'd be more aware of that than I am, I would think, on the ground in a big way. So, as I understand it, in 2015, you were talking about flags and how they can be divisive, and you've said on unionism before, actually, it was an interesting quote. I have an obsession with unionism. I read so much about the Orange Order, so much about unionism, and try to understand it as much as I can. You have to understand unionist fears. We can never talk down the fears of unionist people and what the unionist people have suffered down through the years. And on the flag point, you said, on potentially losing them from games or the anthem. It wouldn't cost me a thought. And, you know, these flags are divisive. Do we need to say that any louder? If somebody was to propose in the morning that they were going to get rid of them all, it wouldn't bother me at all. It's not one of the core values that I have. It's an overtly political thing. It's something which is specific to national borders. It's nothing to do with the cultural. If I thought for a moment that suddenly Tom Elliott would become our greatest fan, I would get rid of them, surely. I've seen you say since that those comments were misrepresented. Where are you on that whole issue? And because I was surprised it blew up in such a big way in 2015.
It did. I suppose when you live in the north and you're living cheek by jowl with the unionist community, and, you know, even last Friday I took a group of students to the Orange Museum in Loch Collin, County Armagh, and they're constantly trying to balance the Irish identity, which is so important to us, with the right of the British people who live in Ireland to have their identity and to have that identity maintained within the context of the United Ireland. And I think the language that we use must always be moderate and must always be cognizant of the fears that unionists have and the amount of suffering that unionists had throughout the conflict that we had with them. And I think one of the things that you must do at all times, instead of concentrating on what your own side suffered, in order for true reconciliation to occur, you must start concentrating on what other people suffered as well that are not on your side. Mm. That's when true reconciliation can happen. Now, in the context of that, I made those remarks, I think, in the middle of July. I was doing an interview with Eamon Malley, and when I was coming into the studio, there was a flag on every single pole, union flag on every pole. Now, the GAA could teach an awful lot of people on how to use our flag. We fly our flag on our own property. We play our anthem before games. We play it very responsibly. We don't do it in any way to be antagonistic. It's very important to us. I know that it is repellent to unionists, but I know that if we did away with the flag and if we did away with the anthem, it still is not going to have unionists playing the game, because we cherish our Irish identity and we cherish our Irishness. What I would say, I suppose, in a more reflective mood would be, because that was sort of thrown on me, that question, that Tricolour is my flag and I'm very proud of it. My national anthem is the Aran na Béan, that I stand very proudly for it and did as a player and do now. But I suppose in the context, if there was ever going to be a border poll that was successful, and you know, at the end of that, there was going to have to be a conversation about what would emerge from this new Ireland. Nobody has a clue, really. If we had it all sorted down to the flag and the anthem, a wee bit like Rule 21, whenever it was debated, and that was the GAA, big move for the peace process, that was banning British security forces from playing our games. What I would say is that the GAA would be imaginative and the GAA would be very responsible in how it responded to that. And I know that that would be repellent to a lot of people who really, really value our flag and value our anthem and would be worried about the prospect within the United Ireland if we lost any of that. Point number one would be that, you know, number one negotiating position would be that it wouldn't change, that our flag is a flag of peace, that it is the representative of both communities. You couldn't draw a better flag that would represent Ireland, the entirety of the island. But it's not something that I am going to obsess over if I become a president of the GAA. There won't be any motion at Congress. There won't be any debate on it. It's something that has followed me around this past few years, with people misquoting me on it. There's the guy who wants to get rid of the flag and anthem. Nothing could be further from the truth. But I'll tell you what is true. If we really, really value ourselves as true Irish people, and if we're really inclusive, and inclusion is one of the six values of the GAA, then we must be prepared to look at every single aspect of the things which are important to us and which repel unionists. Now, I know when Ireland walked out on Saturday morning or Sunday morning against Scotland and they had the flag of Ulster and the flag of Ireland and they played Ireland's call, that is painful for Irish people, for true Irish people, saying, where is our anthem? That is not our anthem. But that is a compromise. And we need to compromise. We need to compromise with our unionist neighbours. And that was the context in which I was saying it. But all of that is theoretical. It's aspirational.
Sure.
I am rooted in the practical. I'm rooted in what our games are about, what we're going to do over the next 3 years. And certainly that won't be any part of what I would be about over the next 3 years.
Yeah.
I would like to reassure people of that, Joe.
Okay. Would you like to see the GAA take a position, an active campaigning position, if a border poll arose over the next decade?
That's something, again, that I said in a remark. It was in an interview at RTE. What I'm saying is that if there was a border poll, if ever there was one, probably the GAA, I'm not saying they should campaign or anything like that, but would certainly have to have a position, the same way as Celtic and Rangers took a position on the Indy Refer in Scotland, same way as Catalonian independence is galvanised around Barcelona and that club, and that's a very important part. It's a valid perspective to have, that an association which cherishes the 32-county ideal and which talks at length in the front page of the Thrower Ifigur about our right to nationhood is impaired by the fact that we are partitioned. But again, these are things which would be going on in the background of a presidency that I would be in charge of. I know that Paddy McFlynn's presidency happened right bang in the middle of the hunger strike, and it defined him, and he had a lot of difficult decisions to make. Interestingly, Peter Quinn's, he was the next six counties president, happened right, the ceasefire occurred just in the middle of his as well. And you know, that something like this might occur in the middle of a Jarlath Burns presidency, let's say, and it's something that I would have to have a position on, and I would like to think I could lead the association responsibly and properly through the challenges without being in any way antagonistic or jingoistic or overly nationalistic. I think that we present our national identity in a very responsible and joyful way, and not in any way in a threatening way, and I think that's the way I would want to continue it.
Okay. Listen, I think we might have to do this interview in a part one, part two style. I don't want you to be late. I had fun topics like Dublin funding, rural decline and the tiered championship all ready to get stuck into with you as well. So we might park them and do them another time. Are you on a campaign trail now? How does this thing work? Do you go around and press the flesh and put your case forward, or is it done through media? Or?
I sent an email to all county secretaries yesterday, and I'll be spending the next 2 or 3 months now going around and talking to county executives about the exact conversation I've been having with you. That's the type of things that they're going to be bringing up and within each county. So that'll be a very busy few months.
Okay, we might try and catch you at some stage in the midst of it all. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Not a problem at all. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jarlath Burns there, who, as you saw, in the last week or so, has put forward his candidacy for GAA president. Back in a sec.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.